to sleep on an open field in the midst of a snowstorm. That morning they had marched for 8 hours and then fought for another 3. And now they were slogging their way through the snow, 800 men lugging the bodies of more than 200 of the dead and wounded. "And I suppose," Church wrote, "everyone that is acquainted with the circumstances of that night's march deeply laments the miseries that attended them, especially the wounded and dying men." The first ones reached the Smith garrison at 2 a.m. Winslow and his entourage became lost and did not arrive at Wickford until 7 in the morning. 22 of the Army's wounded died during the march. The next afternoon, 34 English corpses were buried in a mass grave. 6 more died over the next 2 days. Those wounded who survived the march, including Church and Captain Bradford, who had been injured in the eye, were shipped to Newport on Aquidneck Island for medical treatment. The Puritan historian William Hubbard had an undeniable Massachusetts Bay bias, but after interviewing many of the participants, even he had to admit that Church had been correct. "Many of our wounded men perished, which might otherwise have been preserved if they had not been forced to march so many miles in a cold and snowy night before they could be dressed." The battle became known as the Great Swamp Fight, and more than 20% of the English soldiers had been either killed or wounded, double the casualty rate of the American forces at D-Day. Of all the colonies, Connecticut had suffered the most. Major Treat, who was the last one out of the fort, reported that 4 of his 5 captains had been killed and that 80 of his 300 soldiers were either dead or wounded. This makes for a casualty rate of almost 30%, roughly equivalent to the Confederate losses at Antietam on the bloodiest day of the Civil War. Major Treat insisted that his men return to Connecticut, and despite the outraged objections of Winslow and his staff, who were already contemplating another strike against the Narragansetts, the Connecticut forces marched for Stonington on December 28th. But as Winslow knew all too well, his army was not about to go anywhere. One supply vessel had managed to make it to Wickford, but the rest of the ships were trapped in the ice of Boston Harbor. The severity of the weather meant that it took 5 anxious days before Bostonians heard the news of the Army's hard-fought victory. As late as 1906, the historian George Bodge insisted that the Great Swamp Fight was one of the most glorious victories ever achieved in our history, and, considering the conditions as displaying heroism both in stubborn patience and dashing intrepidity, never excelled in American warfare. It cannot be denied that the assault struck a merciless blow at the Narragansetts. Estimates varied wildly, but somewhere between 350 and 600 native men, women, and children were either shot or incinerated that day. And yet there were still thousands of Narragansetts left alive. If they could make their way north to Nipmuc country, the number of hostile Indian warriors would be more than doubled. Instead of saving New England, Winslow's army had only increased the danger. 2 young sachems were left to head up the remnants of the tribe. Canonchet, who had traveled to Boston that fall to carry on negotiations with Puritan officials, and Quinnipin, who had brazenly announced his defiance of the English by marrying the Pocasset sachem, Weetamoo. Before he had abandoned the fort, Canonchet had been careful to leave a message for the English. In the final minutes of the battle, as the soldiers moved from wigwam to wigwam with firebrands in their hands, one of them had found it, the treaty Canonchet had signed in Boston. The Puritans looked at the document as proof that the Narragansetts had been fully aware of their treaty violations. But as Canonchet now knew for a certainty, it was a piece of parchment that had been worthless from the start. In the weeks ahead, Church lay in a bed in Newport, racked with fever, as his body fought off the infections associated with his wounds. The weather outside remained brutally cold, so cold that 11 of the replacement soldiers sent from Boston during the first week of January died of exposure before they reached Winslow's army at Wickford. On January 14th, some soldiers captured a man who they at first thought was an Indian, but who proved to be an Englishman. His name was Joshua Teft, and he claimed that he had been captured by Canonchet prior to the Great Swamp Fight and forced to become his slave. He had been present at the battle but had not fired a gun. But many soldiers said they had seen him taking part in the fighting. What made Teft's guilt a certainty in many men's minds was his appearance. Without English clothes and with a weather-beaten face, he looked like an Indian to the English. Teft was a troubling example of what happened to a man when the Puritans' God and culture were stripped away and native savagery was allowed to take over. 2 days after his capture, Teft was hanged and, as was befitting a traitor, drawn and quartered. Hubbard claimed there were few tears at his execution. Standers-by being unwilling to lavish pity upon him that had divested himself of nature itself as well as religion in a time when so much pity was needed elsewhere. In the middle of January, the temperature began to rise. A thaw, unlike anything seen in New England since the arrival of the Pilgrims, melted the snow and ice. It was just what the Narragansetts had been waiting for. The English could no longer track them in the snow. To augment their scanty provisions, the Indians could now dig for groundnuts. The time had come for the Narragansetts to make a run for it and join Philip and the Nipmucks to the north. On January 21st, Winslow received word that the Indians were in full flight. Not until almost a week later, on January 27th, did the army, swelled to 1,400 with the arrival of Major Treat's Connecticut forces, begin its pursuit. By this time, Benjamin Church had returned. He was not yet fully recovered, but he agreed to join in what was hoped to be the final knockout punch against the Indians. Reports claimed that there were 4,000 of them, including 1,800 warriors marching north. If they should reach the wilderness of Nipmunk country, New England was in for a winter and spring of violence and suffering. About 10 miles north of Providence, Winslow's soldiers came upon a pile of 60 horse heads. The Narragansetts were scouring the land for anything that was edible. Unfortunately, this left little for the English, who were almost as poorly provisioned as the Indians. On a few occasions, the soldiers leading the English army were able to catch a glimpse of the rear of the Narragansett exodus, only to watch the Indians disappear into the forest as soon as they came under attack. Without sufficient supplies of food, and with no way to engage the enemy, the morale of the English soldiers deteriorated with each day, and desertions became endemic. The temperature started to plummet once again, and illness swept through the English ranks. Even General Winslow was reported to be suffering from the flux. Several days into what became known as the Hungry March, they came upon some wigwams beside an icy swamp. After exchanging gunfire, the Indians fled, although a friendly Mohegan managed to capture a Narragansett warrior who had been wounded in the leg. That night, the Indian captive was brought before General Winslow for interrogation. It appeared to Church that the Narragansett was surprisingly forthcoming, but some of Winslow's advisers suggested that they torture him until he offered a more ample confession. Church, who doubted that the Indian had anything more to divulge, insisted that he be allowed to live. Once again, Church's advice was ignored. It was pointed out that the captive was injured, and they were in the midst of a strenuous march. To prevent the Narragansett from slowing them down the next day, it was decided that he must be executed. The Indian was taken over to a large bonfire, where the Mohegan who had captured him prepared to cut off his head. Taking no delight in the sport, Church limped over to where the army's supply horses were standing in the cold, jets of steam flowing from their nostrils. Church was about 50 yards from the fire when the Mohegan raised his hatchet. Just as the weapon was about to slice through his neck, the Narragansett jerked his head to the side and broke free of the Mohegan's grasp. Despite his injury, he began to run directly, it turned out, for Benjamin Church, who was concealed in the darkness beyond the glow of the fire. Church was still so lame that he needed the help of at least two people to mount his horse. He had tents in his wounds, plugs of gauze used to promote the drainage of pus and blood. This did not prevent him from tackling the Narragansett, who was stark naked and slippery with bear grease. After rolling around together on the ground, the Indian broke free of Church's grasp and was running once again, this time with Church in close pursuit. Since they were both wounded, there were, in Church's words, no great odds in the race. They were lumbering over a frozen swamp, and the ice crackled so loudly with each of their steps that Church hoped his English friends back at the fire would follow the noise and come to his assistance, even though it was impossible to see much of anything in the starless night. The Indian might have escaped if he had not blundered into a tree and nearly knocked himself out. Soon the two of them were once again rolling around on the ground. This time the Indian grabbed Church by the hair and was attempting to twist his head and break his neck. Church's wounds had somewhat weakened him, but he did his best to fight back by applying several notorious bunts in the Indian's face with his head. As they mauled each other, Church could hear the welcome sound of cracking ice approaching from the fire. It proved to be the Mohegan. Feeling for them in the dark, he determined who was the naked Indian and who was the clothed Englishman, and, with one blow, settled his hatchet in between them and ended the strife. The Mohegan gave Church a thankful hug and then cut off the head of his victim and carried it to the camp. By February 5th, the Hungry March had reached the town of Marlborough at the eastern fringes of Nipmuc country. Winslow decided that he had no choice but to disband his army. Church returned to his pregnant wife Alice and their son Thomas, who had been staying with family and friends in Duxbury. The march had been an unmitigated catastrophe. Back in December, colonial officials had hoped to wipe the Narragansetts off the face of the earth. Instead, they had flushed thousands of them into the arms of the enemy. The Puritans had claimed it was common knowledge among the Indians that the Narragansetts were planning to join the war in the spring. However, no one seems to have informed the Nipmucks of this plan. When the first Narragansett warriors began to arrive in January, they were shot at. As far as the Nipmucks knew, they were still traitors to the cause and had, in all likelihood, joined the English. Only after the Narragansetts had presented them with English scalps as proof of their loyalty did the Nipmuc sachems begin to realize that they had a new and powerful ally. Thanks to the intervention of the English in Rhode Island, there was yet another tribe eager to take up the fight. But where were Philip and the Poconokets? Chapter 15. In a strange way. Sick, desperate, and fast becoming irrelevant to the war he had started, Philip and his small band of warriors headed more than 50 miles west to the Hudson River Valley. In late December, they made camp at Scaticoke on the Hoosick River, an eastern tributary of the Hudson. It was here, in the colony of New York, where a remnant of the original Dutch settlers still actively traded with the Indians, and where the Hudson River provided access to the French to the north, that Philip hoped to stage his triumphant return to the war. That fall, Philip had met with a French official on his way back to Canada after a visit to Boston. The Frenchman had presented the sachem with an ornate brass gun and pledged his country's support in his war against the English. Specifically, he had promised Philip 300 Indian warriors from Canada and all the powder and shot he needed. He even claimed the French Navy would set up a blockade along the coast of New England to stop the flow of English supplies from Europe. But the Frenchman also had some requests of Philip. He asked that he and his warriors not burn the meeting houses, mills, and best houses. "For we intend to be with you in the spring before planting season," he said, "and possess ourselves of the Connecticut River and other English plantations." Philip was once again following in his father's footsteps. He too was attempting to strengthen his decimated tribe through an alliance with a European power. There was no guarantee that the French would be any more trustworthy than the English in the long run. But at least for now, Philip would have the warriors and ammunition he desperately needed. So he and his men, led by his principal captain, Anawan, established winter quarters at Scaticoke and waited for the French and their native allies. In early January, New York Governor Edmund Andros worriedly wrote to officials in New England that Philip had been joined by 300 or 400 North Indians, fighting men, at Scaticoke. By February, Philip's forces had reportedly grown to 2,100 and included 600 French Indians with straws in their noses. Although this figure was undoubtedly exaggerated, Philip had succeeded beyond all expectations in assembling one of the largest forces of Indian warriors in the region. But there was another native group to consider. The Mohawks, a powerful subset of the Iroquois, lived in the vicinity of Albany and were the most feared warriors in the Northeast. In addition to being the traditional enemies of the Indians of southern New England, they had a special hatred of the French and their Indian allies to the north. Yet if Philip could somehow succeed in bringing the Mohawks into the war on his side, he would be in a position to bring the New England colonies to their knees. But Philip was not the only one seeking an alliance with the Mohawks. Governor Andros also hoped to enlist their aid. Unlike the Puritan magistrates, who viewed all Indians as potential enemies, Andros saw the Mohawks and the rest of the Iroquois as powerful independent entities that must be dealt with diplomatically rather than through force and intimidation. Andros and the Iroquois were in the midst of creating what became known as the Covenant Chain, a mutually beneficial partnership between the colony and the Iroquois that would stand for generations. It became Andros's mission to persuade the Mohawks that Philip and the tribes to the east were a threat to that alliance. But it may have been Philip instead of Andros who ultimately brought the Mohawks over to the English side. According to the Puritan historian Increase Mather, the Poconoket sachem decided he must resort to a deception if he was going to create an alliance with the Mohawks. So he and his warriors killed a scattering group of Mohawks and blamed the murders on the English. Unknown to Philip, one of the Mohawks had escaped and reported that the Poconoket sachem was behind the attack. Whether or not Philip was, as Mather maintained, the cause of his own downfall, sometime in late February, the Mohawks attacked his forces in Scaticoke. By all accounts, it was a rout. On March 4th, Governor Andros witnessed the triumphant return of the Mohawks to Albany. In addition to plenty of prisoners, they proudly displayed the scalps of the many Indians they had killed. Once again, Philip's forces were on the run, this time headed east, back to the Connecticut River. Instead of leading an invincible native army, Philip was back to being a mere sachem with a reputation for grandstanding and defeat. The future of the war was in others' hands. His name was Job Catananit. He was a praying Indian being held on Deer Island. Before he had been transported to the island, his village had been attacked by the Nipmucks, who'd taken his three children captive. By December, Job, who was a widower, was desperate to find his children, and he and another praying Indian named James volunteered to become spies for the English. They were to infiltrate the Nipmucks at Manamasset, the village near Brookfield to which Philip had fled after escaping from Plymouth, and learn anything they could about the Indians' plans for the winter. If Job was lucky, he might also make contact with his three children. It was dangerous duty, to be sure, but James and Job could truthfully tell the Nipmucks that they had been so abused and reviled by the English that they had been given no choice but to leave them. James was the first to return on January 24th. He reported that the Nipmucks had at first threatened to kill them, but a sachem who had fought with James against the Mohawks several years earlier spoke in his defense, and they had been allowed to live. Job had located his children, who were all still alive, and he had decided to remain with them at Manamasset for as long as possible. James reported to Daniel Gookin that the Nipmucks had rejoiced much when they learned that the Narragansetts had been forced to join their struggle. Now that most of the English towns along the Massachusetts portion of the Connecticut River had been abandoned, the Indians planned to attack the settlements to the east, including Medfield, Marlborough, Sudbury, Groton, and Concord. But it would begin with Lancaster.